Here now is your host for today's program, Ruth Copeland.
Welcome to the show. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copeland. And in case you're a new listener to the show, I just wanted to let you know in the first hour, we look at all kinds of topics from all kinds of angles, attempting to see if we have more in common than divides us, focusing on debate rather than one-sided conversations, and covering issues with local relevance even, and yet global significance. And we keep a balance between the left and right brain with the second hour, featuring an in-depth interview with a guest from the arts. And if you are new to the show, a bit of background on me. I'm British, but I've lived in Santa Cruz for over 10 years, and I'm also an American citizen. I have a professional background in the arts, in music, writing, and performance, and also in psychotherapy and business. If you'd like to contact me, you can email ruth@ksco.com. I'd be interested in your thoughts on the show and also issues you might want me to cover. I'll also try to monitor that email address during the show if you'd like to give your opinion that way. So that's ruth@ksco.com. I'd also be interested if you have any suggestions for guests from the arts, do let me know. You can follow me on Twitter and message me there. My Twitter name is @RuthCopeland. And you can find me on Facebook, ruth.copeland.1. You're listening on KSCO AM 1080, or maybe to the live stream at ksco.com, which enables us to have listeners around America and the world. So wherever you are, welcome. And having been broadcasting from Britain for the last few weeks, I'm now back in the KSCO studio. And it's good to be back. It's a beautiful day. It's 76, I think my car said. I don't know what Dave said it was, but it's pretty nice. Although when I left England, it was also very nice. I felt like I had brought the California weather with me to England after all the terrible floods and everything they'd been having and just epic rain. I think the most rain for 250 years or something. I didn't get to see any of it, and I also missed the rain here. So considering that perversely I actually quite like rain, I sort of missed out really in both places. But anyway, for most people it's really good because it's been lovely and sunny. In the second hour today, just after three, I'll be interviewing my guest from the arts this week. And the guests that we have from the arts are local, national, and internationally successful artists. And some of them are all of those things in one. And the guest that I have today is one of those people. I'm very happy to have live in the studio with me internationally best-selling novelist and screenwriter and Santa Cruz resident, Michael Marshall Smith. We'll be talking about his 20-plus year career and also his latest novel, We Are Here, which has been described as chilling, intelligent, and profoundly unsettling. Born in Britain, Michael spent the first 7 years of his childhood in Illinois and Florida, as well as a year in South Africa and another in Australia before returning to the UK. He's lived in Santa Cruz for the last 3 years with his wife and son, though. Having started out writing and performing comedy with the Footlights at Cambridge University, and there's a lot of very successful actors, directors, all kinds of creative people who started out in the Footlights, Emma Thompson and Sam Mendes being two, I believe. And he subsequently also performed comedy at the BBC. Michael has gone on to write dark suspense fiction with a hint of the supernatural. He is the winner of the Philip K. Dick Award, the August Derleth Award for Best Novel, 6 British Fantasy Awards, and the only author ever to win the BFS Award for Best Short Story 4 times. Stephen King referred to his Straw Men trilogy as a masterpiece, brilliantly written. His novel Spares was optioned by Steven Spielberg's DreamWorks, and his supernatural thriller The Intruders is currently being filmed for TV by BBC America and stars John Sim and Mira Sorvino. I'm very pleased he's agreed to come on the show, and I hope you can stick around till just after three to hear that interview. So that's Michael Marshall Smith, just after three today. So what have we got coming up this hour? This week, the topic is, should integrity be part of conducting business? Or is it dog eat dog all the way to the bank? If you have any thoughts on this, you can call the studio on 831-479-1080. I'd love to hear from you. I guess to start with, maybe we should define what we mean by integrity. The Oxford Dictionary definition of integrity is the quality of being honest and having strong moral principles. And the example it gives is a gentleman of complete integrity. And I thought that was rather an old-fashioned example in some ways, hailing from a time when the word gentleman itself embodied a host of high values, of which integrity was but one. Barbara Killinger offers a traditional definition. Integrity is a personal choice, an uncompromising and predictably consistent commitment to honour moral, ethical, spiritual and artistic values and principles. And if you think of integrity in terms of ethics, it's regarded as the honesty and truthfulness or accuracy of one's actions. And it's the opposite, fairly obviously, of hypocrisy. And it comes originally from the Latin adjective integer, which means whole or complete. So looked at in this way, integrity is the inner sense of wholeness deriving from qualities such as honesty and consistency of character. And if we think about it in this way, one may judge that others have integrity to the extent that they act according to the values, beliefs and principles they can claim to hold, which I guess, you know, more commonly is called walking your talk. That's a good way of seeing if somebody has integrity. And this seems particularly appropriate if we think about business. We want to think we can trust people individually to do as they say, and that we can trust businesses and corporations to act in accordance with the values that they promote to us, that they're going to do what they say and act in a way that they say they are going to. And this topic interested me this week due to two different stories. The first one was a kind of personal story, and the second one was a story, you know, that I read in the press. And the first story involves a friend of mine. I'm going to call him Keith, which is not his real name. And he shared with me how frustrated he had been by a current business deal he was doing to purchase a commercial property. The deal was all agreed. Keith had lined up tenants for the property. The contract was 3 days away from being signed when suddenly the agent came back to him and said that someone else was interested, and unless he paid $150,000 more, the deal was off. And Keith was incensed. He kept saying to me, "It's the principle. You do a deal you're happy with and you honor it. It's the principle." And he's a very successful businessman and he does a lot of property deals. And he said that when he is selling, he makes a deal he's happy with and he sticks with it. He said he's done deals where the buyer has gone on to resell the property for more, but he was happy with the deal he made at the time. And that's all that he bases his dealings on. And he would never renege on a deal once it's been made. And in this particular instance, Keith had spent a lot in lawyer's fees to get to the point of signing the contract. And if he walked away, he'd be looking at a loss. So the sellers had the opportunity to exploit that position. And, you know, he really felt that they lacked integrity. He also couldn't believe that they hadn't approached him directly in person rather than through the agent to explain the situation and perhaps offer a compromise. And he went ahead and completed the deal because it was still to his advantage, but, you know, left a bad taste in his mouth. And he said to me, you know, in his opinion, what goes around comes around. And reputation is everything. A few more deals like that, and the sellers may find they have no one to deal with as they become known for lacking integrity. And this story made me think a lot of different things, but I'm wondering how it strikes you. Do you agree with Keith that once a deal is made, you should be principled and honor it? Or do you think that he's naive to think that anyone would turn down extra money simply because they gave their word. And if you have any thoughts on this, do call the studio on 831-479-1080. And I know it's not everyone's cup of tea to call in and speak on the air, but it is really interesting to get different perspectives. So I do encourage you to join the conversation. The number again is 831-479-1080. And Keith has made a lot of money, so his way of doing business with integrity does work. But could he have made a lot more money if he had been less principled? You know, it's something to think about. But also, might he have earned less money if he gained a reputation for being a shark? His way of conducting business has an implicit understanding of a fair profit. He's doing a deal he's happy with based on his numbers at any given time. He's not basing his decisions on greed, on squeezing the maximum profit out of the deal, no matter how you do it, which is a very different approach to the sellers in this situation that I'm describing. So I'm just wondering, this is a very kind of personal to me, but also a sort of less corporate way of looking at integrity, more sort of small business. How much should integrity be part of conducting business? Or is it just dog eat dog all the way to the bank? We're just in business to make money, and as long as you're not doing anything illegal, you know, is that kind of good enough? I'm wondering if we think of business as part of our whole life, as an extension of who we are as people, and so we imbue it with our core values, or is it more of a battle zone where the ends justify the means? If you'd like to give your take on this, you can call me on 831-479-1080. I think it's quite an interesting thing to think about. And I think it's also interesting to think about which side of the deal you're on. You know, are you on the side that's receiving kind of the benefit in the case of these sellers? You know, they suddenly apparently had someone offering them 150,000 more, you know, so you're on that side. What do you do then? You made your deal. You made a promise, yes, but suddenly you can get $150,000 more. Or does it make a difference if you're the other person, if you're Keith, who has, you know, put money in, he's invested, he's committed, he's been there, he's kept his word, he hasn't dropped out. You know, the deal's been done, there's a few days to go. From his perspective, you know, it looks really lacking in integrity. But I'm just wondering if it makes a difference what side of the equation you're on. So, as I said, give me a call, 831-479-1080. I'd love to hear your opinion on this. And we've got Craig in Hawaii, who's called in. Craig, you're on with Ruth Copeland, and it's a question of balance. Thanks for calling in.
Hi, Ruth. Boy, I get all nervous as soon as it's time to talk.
I think everybody does. It's like your mind goes blank. You call up, and then you go, oh, no, what was I going to say?
Well, my initial reaction or thought was that it's the lawyers that determine the rules in that game. Mm. And it is dog eat dog. And if you intend to play there, unfortunately, you're going to be, you know, you're basically making deals with the devil from time to time. I think in life, in general, we have to have integrity and manners. I think we discussed manners.
Yeah.
Last time I called in.
Right. Yes. I remember that.
And the question is, I think you're really asking would be, Does the means justify the ends?
Yep, that's exactly it. That's a big topic for me personally, because I feel that most of the bad stuff that happens in the world is carried out on that basis, to be honest, you know, that the ends justify the means. So what do you think about that?
Well, I'd like to be a survivor. In other words, when it comes to war, I'd rather be on the winning side. But I believe in humanity, So I think there is a right and a wrong, and integrity is important. I think the size of the jungle makes a difference. In other words, if you're in a small town and you elbow your way around like as if you were in the big city, you're overplaying your hands, and it won't work in your favor at all. I think it's just the shooting stars that can live on the fringes and enjoy the fruits of that. But that doesn't necessarily yield a better life for ourselves and for everyone else around us. So I stick with integrity. I guess I have to raise my hand with that. But if you're in that business, specifically the commercial real estate business, you're going to have to make some deals with the devil from time to time. You're going to get hurt.
Now, what that supposing that you're taking the line, though, that making money is the only thing that matters, because, I mean, you don't have to make a deal with the devil, do you? I mean, no one's forcing you to. It's just money.
Well, there's bean counters that have an opinion, and that is you need more in this silo than you have in a different silo. You need more money. I mean, that's the golden rule to business, if you just coldly look at it that way.
Right. As it currently stands, yes. I mean, one of my interests is the idea of fair profit, which is,
yeah.
No, you're like, no.
Idealism. Idealism, that's what pops into my mind, and I wish we could go there.
Yeah.
I wish we could. Maybe I've been revisiting Machiavelli, The Prince, a little too much recently.
Yeah, maybe. Well, there are some people in the world who are doing it a different way. There are entrepreneurs who are going more for a fair profit and, you know, paying their employees more and, you know, increasing employee engagement through various practices and just accepting their profit isn't as large, but they're still making a profit that they're happy with. And I think, you know, that's maybe where an adjustment could come.
May I raise a real quick example?
Yeah, of course.
I was successful in bringing in a new an account for an employer, and it was on the level of millions of dollars per year. That was the potential of the account, if not maybe a little bit more. And upon the first purchase order, my employer wanted to reduce my 2% to a 1% commission retroactively.
Wow.
And I no longer had any affection for the company.
No,
I can put
imagine.
It that way.
Yeah.
So I would have appreciated a big, huge thank you, and here's your commission, and then look, here's a big picture. We need to kind of do things differently now. You know, some other approach would have been beneficial for everyone in this case.
Yeah. Well, so, I mean, that was an action that certainly lacked in integrity, wasn't it? And it kind of, what you're saying mirrors what my friend was saying about what happened in his deal, which was he said they could have come to me directly and said, look, we're sorry, someone else has come in, could you meet us halfway, could you, you know, what can you do? But it was just sort of very kind of like, look, give us more money or you're out.
It's a hold up. He was victim of a hold up.
Yeah.
Now, who orchestrated it? Who knows? But you know what? If you waste your time thinking about that, it isn't really worth your time. You have to walk. He's going to have to walk away from it. Sounds like fortunately it worked. It's going to work in his favor. But all of those on the other side, he's not going to want to work with them again. Is it worth it for the amount of money? Who knows?
Yeah.
I think not. I vote with it for the integrity side of it.
Yeah.
But.
Well, certainly, like what happened to you, that affected your whole response to the company. Well, your family,
yeah.
I mean, your life, but also, I mean, you didn't want to work for that company anymore, I should imagine.
Absolutely not. I lost all my love for them. And it's happened twice subsequently in two other subsequent employment contracts. It's happened three times. This account is a hot potato. So I've come to really, I guess I'm a little jaded. There's an element of control that some people must own over a certain amount of money.
Yeah.
And they can't detach themselves from that, and they'll make a decision that hurts others.
That's true. Craig, I have to go to a commercial break. Did you want to hold on over the break?
No. I would love to talk with you more, but I'm probably boring everyone. Thank you. I want to listen to you talk.
Okay. Thank you're not boring me. Thank you very much for calling in. I was interested in your views. Thank you. And we're going to go to commercial break now. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copeland on KSCO AM 1080.
Off the Live Earth Farm Discovery Program Spring Fun Drive at our Sheep to Shawl Fair on Saturday, March 22nd from 10 to 2 at 1275 Green Valley Road in Watsonville. The fair will feature hands-on fiber activities and local artisan vendors. All of the funds raised will provide scholarships for local youth to attend farm camps. Campers will learn to grow and prepare healthy seasonal foods in our garden, kitchen classroom, chicken pasture, goat pen, and new this year, Pony Corral. Visit our website for more information at www.liveearthfarm.net/discovery-program.
Hi, registered pharmacist Ben Fuchs here. I've been studying healthy bodies for 35 years, and what I've got to tell you may shock and surprise you, but if you listen up, it may change your life. Lecithin is an active ingredient in bile, the body's soap or detergent that's charged with the role of dissolving fatty substances from foods so that the rest of the body can have access to them. Lecithin can also help the body absorb minerals like calcium and magnesium. And because it's so readily available as a dietary supplement, and it's really inexpensive, it's a cheap way to support health and wellness. Because lecithin is found throughout nature, there's lots of foods you can use to give yourself a lecithin bump. You can get lecithin in organ meats, seeds, and butter. Eggs are nature's richest source because cholesterol is also dissolved in bile. Lecithin can protect you from gallstones too. Gallstones can result from poorly dissolved or crystallized cholesterol. Under ordinary and healthy circumstances, cholesterol stays in the bile. However, if our cells are making too much cholesterol, it can precipitate out in crystals and form little rocks or stones, so-called gallstones, which can clog up the tiny tubes in the gallbladder. If this sounds familiar, the last thing you want to do is what 500,000 people do every year, and that's have your gallbladder removed. If you have a history of gallstone formation, you want to make sure you're using lecithin, especially with fatty meals. Aside from the aforementioned food sources, you can get lecithin as a liquid or in capsules. It's also available as a powder that you can blend into a protein drink. It tastes great, and it'll give your smoothie a nice, smooth, creamy texture, too. Pharmacist Ben here, urging you to go to KSCOhealth.com to order Beyond Tangy Tangerine, the Healthy Start Pack, and other nutritional supplements that I personally use and recommend. You can purchase these premium quality products at wholesale prices online at KSCOhealth.com. That's KSCOhealth.com. I'm a pharmacist that believes that staying healthy and strong is not only about medicine, it's about giving your body the raw materials it needs to do its work. Go to KSCOhealth.com. Make sure you check out the cool videos, too, at KSCOhealth.com. That's KSCOhealth.com.
Hello, this is Donald Davidson, the host of the Perspectives radio show on Saturday at 12 noon. We have a variety of programs from constitutional rights and issues to controversial alternative health views. We interview well-known authors from many walks of life, attorneys from many fields, and internationally known health doctors. So, to hear a different perspective, join me, Donald Davidson, special guests and regular guest hosts every Saturday at 12 noon for the Perspectives radio show, right here on KSCO.
Welcome back to It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copeland. This hour, we're discussing, should integrity be part of conducting business, or is it dog eat dog all the way to the bank? And we just heard from Craig in Hawaii, who was sharing some examples of where he had not been treated with integrity by companies that he had worked for, where he'd been promised one deal and then retroactively they had reneged on that. And we also were talking about another deal, a property deal that a friend of mine did, where he was just suddenly asked to pay $150,000 more, or the deal was off like 2 days before they were going to sign. So we're looking at, you know, is that just part of doing business? And I think Craig was saying that he's fairly jaded, and I guess he's just accepted that it is a jungle out there. But part of thinking about this story made me think about what are we in business for? Is it just about making money? Or are we also trying to conduct business in such a way that we respect others and gain their respect? Do we think of business as just part of our whole life? Or do we think of it as an extension of the rest of our life, of who we are as people? And so we imbue it with our core values, because otherwise we're kind of being two people. I mean, assuming that we are trying to have integrity in our personal life, if we don't in business, then we're having a bit of a split personality. And Craig also brought something up that I was going to bring up, which is interesting. Do the ends justify the means? And I think this is used a lot to justify all kinds of things. But certainly in business, I think that applies. So if you'd like to give a call, give your take on this, the number is 831-479-1080. And I encourage you to call in and give your views, even if you're like Craig and you feel a bit nervous about calling in. Just think you're just having a conversation on the phone with me, not with anyone else. And then it seems a bit less daunting, I think. The other story that made me choose this topic of discussion this week was reading that in the Netherlands, all bank employees are going to be required to swear an oath of integrity, optionally to God, but they are going to be required to swear an oath of integrity. And this is a response to the banking crisis driven by greed that caused widespread recession and millions of people to suffer hardship. And CNBC's Kieran Moodley states, starting next year, Dutch bank employees must swear an oath, optionally to God, promising they will perform their duties with integrity and that they will endeavor to maintain confidence in the financial sector. And this banker's oath has been around for a while, but it used to be simply self-regulation. But it's now in the Dutch statute books and must be adhered to by every one of the Netherlands' 90,000 bank employees. And the purpose of it, the new code with the banker's oath, seeks to engage much more in the public debate and show the public and stakeholders the things banks are doing and the contributions banks can make to society. And Laura Spence, who's the professor of business ethics at Royal Holloway, University of London, which is where I did my English literature degree, so I can vouch for it. She said that the Dutch response was an attempt to make the banking profession similar to medicine and its Hippocratic Oath. She said they're really trying to professionalize the industry and bring the kind of levels of integrity and expectation around integrity in line with other of the more established professions. And Professor Spence was emphasizing that the Netherlands have seemed to grasp the fact that self-regulation and voluntary approaches towards banking conduct are not enough and that rules need to be enforced. And this seems to be something that a lot of countries do agree on. Banks have not demonstrated that they can police themselves very well. However, the Netherlands' new banking code and the oath of integrity is rather a novel response. And the idea of that with the code is based on ensuring openness across all levels of the banking sector so that if a low-level employee seeks something that violates the code, they will feel empowered to speak out. So I'm wondering what you think about this. Swearing an oath of integrity, would that make a difference to our banking system here in America? Do you think that would make people stop and think a bit more before they just made decisions that are really only in their own interest? If you have a thought on this, the number's 831-479-1080. Well, the Dutch Banking Association chairman, Chris Buijink, not sure I've pronounced that correctly, but it's my best attempt. He says, we feel that it's important to have an open culture where people feel free to challenge ideas and people should be invited to speak up. You should not have a culture where you have a supreme leader that surrounds itself with clones. But will this work? I guess at least the Netherlands is trying to address the causes of the crisis, which is more than can be said for many other countries. where everything seems to have gone a bit quiet, really. Well, the ordinary people are wondering how no one went to jail, to be quite honest. So at least the Netherlands is putting something forward. They're trying. And most of the talk about trying to prevent the same thing happening again centers around changes to financial and legal regulations, rather than how to change the culture and behavior of banks, which would include how to maintain integrity. And Rosamund Thomas, who's the director of the Center for Business and Public Sector Ethics in Cambridge, she says it is no excuse for leaders of banks and other financial institutions involved in the financial crisis of 2007-10 to continue the practices which led to the global collapse. But are we really seeing a difference in that behavior? Have things changed at all? What do you think? Should we follow the example of the Netherlands and require banking employees to swear an oath of integrity in America? Is this a right step in the right direction to protect the public's interest? Or is it wrong to legislate ethical behavior? Is that just something that shouldn't be done? We shouldn't be trying to control ethical behavior with legislation. And perhaps even more to the point, is it possible to enforce such an oath of integrity if it was broken? I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. You can call the studio on 831-479-1080. We're going to go to a commercial break now, but do join us after the break. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copland on KSCO AM 1080.
Did you know that 9 out of 10 couples don't agree on the firmness of their mattress? That's right, 90%. He likes it firmer, she likes it softer, or vice versa. And the only bed offered that allows you to each have your own way is the Sleep Number bed. Dual air technology is what makes it possible. It's a simple concept, but unique to Sleep Number. Each side of the bed is individually adjustable to whatever degree of firmness or softness you happen to want at the touch of a button. My Sleep Number is 85. I need a firm mattress, and that's what works for me. I've had back problems, and this makes me sleep well. I get up relaxed and refreshed. Celeste couldn't handle that. Her Sleep Number setting is 50. But with that difference in setting, both of us sleep well on Sleep Number. So will you. Go to Seaside, California, right next to the Cost Plus World Trade Market on Fremont Street, and you'll find a Sleep Number store well-stocked with all of their models. Go get a demonstration and move up from a conventional mattress to the Sleep Number mattress. Tell me you heard about it from Charlie Friedman at KSCO.
Folks, Michael Olson here at Santa Cruz Electronics, where doing it yourself is going to a whole new level. Just witnessed cutting-edge technology, CNC milling machine. John Bowers, what does this machine do?
It whittles away material from whatever it is you're working with and removes everything until you get to the shape of the part that you want.
Just saw John mill out his own wrench from a chunk of material. He put a computer program in, turned the machine on. The machine said, yes, John, here's your wrench. This is a game-changer technology.
It certainly is. It actually allows, you and I and other folks to be able to do small-scale manufacturing right out of their garage.
Come down here to Santa Cruz Electronics on Soquel Avenue and get a demonstration, learn how to do it.
It's great fun and can be rewarding, too.
Come and look at it right here at Santa Cruz Electronics.
2808 Soquel Avenue.
It's a CNC milling machine. Dream up a widget in the morning and have it done in the afternoon and put it on eBay at night. Just like that, right, John?
You bet.
Currently online at KSCODeals.com for a very limited time is the best deal ever offered on a Longevity Healthy Start Pack. Sign up as a Longevity Associate for a one-time $10 sign-up fee, buy a Healthy Start Pack on AutoShip, and get a second Healthy Start Pack, a $118 value, free. This offer applies only to online associate, not customer, signups at KSCODeals.com, and free product is available only for pickup at KSCO Studios on Portola Drive in Santa Cruz. Be a hero to your body. Go to KSCODeals.com, sign up as a longevity associate, order a Healthy Start Pack on AutoShip, and get another Healthy Start Pack free. Do it now.
Listen to KSEO presents Ethan Behrman every Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday from noon to 2.
Let's go to Santa Cruz, because I know there's a population of people there that try and stop law enforcement from doing their job. They have judges that sit on the courts there. They don't punish criminals. They don't put people in jail or prison. They say, oh, society's done you so wrong, poor pot smuggler. Here's a blanket. Here's a meal. Better yet, here's a place to sleep, and we're going to get you meals. We're going to make sure that even though you're caught, you're not going to serve time. Well, how dare we deport you back to Mexico for smuggling drugs here from Mexico? No, no, no. We're a sanctuary city. We're not going to cooperate with federal law enforcement to make sure you get punished properly.
Santa Cruz, sanctuary city for Mexican pot smugglers. What's next? Don't miss KSCO presents Ethan Behrman, weekdays except Wednesday from noon to 2 on KSCO AM 1080.
Welcome back. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copland. Just to let you know, in the second hour today, my guest from the arts is internationally best-selling novelist and screenwriter and also Santa Cruz resident Michael Marshall Smith. And we'll be talking about his 20-plus year career and his latest novel, We Are Here, and also the filming of his novel, The Intruders, which is being made by BBC America as we speak. So hopefully you can stick around and hear my interview with him just after the news at 3 o'clock. This hour, we've been talking about, should integrity be part of conducting business, or is it dog eat dog all the way to the bank? And in the first part of the show, I was talking about a kind of small business example of somebody reneging on a deal, and we were thinking about what that looks like and whether it's different which side of the deal that you're on, your perspective of it. Do the ends justify the means? And then I was also talking about the fact that in the Netherlands, they are now requiring by law that you take an oath of integrity if you're going to work in the banking industry. And just wondering whether that would be effective, how you would enforce it, and also whether that's something that we would want to happen in America. Obviously, the banking industry has really fallen very low in a lot of people's opinion due to the crisis, and it seems to be very much business as usual. So what do you think about that? Do you think an oath of integrity would make people stop and think a bit more? Should we be doing that in America? You can call the studio on 831-479-1080. And we've got a caller on the line, Jim from Reno, Nevada. You're listening to, or you're talking to Ruth Copland on It's a Question of Balance. Hello, Jim.
Hello. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
Great. I don't know the whole topic you're talking about, because I kind of got in a little bit late. But I got alerted to when you said fair profit. That word just makes me cringe, because I just don't think there is such a fair thing as fair profit. Who judges that? I think that each person needs to decide on what is a decent profit in which to keep operating. I don't think that there is a way of really judging what a fair profit actually is, in my opinion.
Well, what I was meaning by that is that the company does set the idea, or the business owner does set the idea of what they consider to be a fair profit. So it wouldn't be something that would be legislated or imposed by the government or something like that. It would be d- do I want to squeeze every last cent out of this, no matter what I have to do, no matter who I step over to get there? You know, that I pay my employees less, I don't give them benefits, but I'm, you know, squeezing out the most? Or do I think about, well, I can make a decent profit, as you're saying, and maybe, you know, create a little bit better imprint in the world?
Yeah, I think that, you know, a lot of people do operate in the premise of squeezing the most out of every single transaction, of course, because that's, you know, that is really a primary driver for people to survive in this world. You get the highest margins for the least amount of effort. That is just, that's particularly human nature in the business world. But you also have to factor in long-term goals, as in, what does this do for my next deal with the same person, or how does it relate to the current marketplace? So, you know, I think that when you're looking at a long view, you've got to, you know, play into those factors of, you know, what is really going to be my reputation down the road? And I think as a small business person, you really are sort of judging every decision you make on how is it best for the company, both monetarily and optically, and in future relationships. So I think a lot of small businesses are doing something similar to what you're discussing about, you know, making proper decisions for the health of the company that may also be a fair and decent profit at the same time. I think most people are operating to that. Obviously, there's outliers, you know, either direction. But I think the bulk of businesses, which is what you can typically affect, is already doing what you're describing, I think.
Right. Yeah. No, I think that makes a lot of sense. What we were talking about before also was, you know, is business, what you do in your business life, an extension of who you are, or are you operating as a completely different person with a different set of values in your business? And, you know, in some ways that seems a bit strange. You know, if people do have integrity in their personal life, but they're willing to do anything to kind of get the deal in their business life, I don't know what you feel about that.
Well, I don't think anyone's business mirrors their personality away from business exactly the same. I just don't think that anyone can have a straight across philosophy that works for both. I think that there are overlaps for sure. So, you know, I think that doing deals that you know are bad because you're forced into it, or business out of fear, making bad deals because of fear get a lot of people in trouble. A wise person once told me, you know, change before you have to. And that enables you to make business decisions before you have to be ruled by circumstances out of your control. So I think that if you operate with that in mind, you have a lot more space and time in which to make decisions that may be more fair for everyone, or, you know, at least a better deal for your company as well.
Right. That's a good point, that often perhaps, you know, not so good decisions are made under pressure. And if you can avoid that pressure, then you might be going to make better decisions. We were talking about, I don't know if you heard about the oath of integrity that the Dutch banking system is going to require all their bank employees to take. Is that something you think might help the American banking industry? Is that something you have an opinion on?
I think the American banking system is lost to moral compasses altogether. So, I think that it is a decrepit organization or trade group that has manipulated the American public, American legislators, and the Federal Reserve in such a way that, you know, they almost become untouchable, which is dangerous. So I don't think that they have, there will be no way that kind of oath would ever happen. And could it help? No. It wouldn't help, because those people that are doing it by moral grounds are already doing it, and those that aren't will not change.
Right. Yeah. Well, I think one of the big problems is the culture of companies, and that is more what needs to change, I think, because if everyone around you is just carrying out those kind of practices, and the only way you can compete is to also make these kind of dodgy and greed-led decisions, then you really don't have anywhere else to go if your company is supporting that kind of behavior. So
it's interesting that they'd even propose or the oath even towards God is optional. Now, didn't Jesus hate the moneylenders? Didn't he decry moneylenders, and all of a sudden now we're asking bankers to take an oath to God?
Well, I think the reason it was optional is because, you know, I mean, people who have a faith in God, then that makes them make a pretty serious commitment, you know, so that's probably what, but if you don't believe in God, then it's not going to mean anything, is it? But, yeah, I think the Bible generally, I think most of the world's major monotheistic religions don't support money lending in any way, although most of them have kind of finagled to the point where they've made it okay to do it. But my understanding is it's not looked upon as something that should be done, probably for all the reasons that we've seen in the current crisis, that it does just engender greed more than when products and services are involved, when it's just money making money off money.
Yeah, I don't know. It's almost as if every organization then should be doing, shall I say that, oath to God, or optional, an oath to the people they serve to do things morally. But it is strange in the fact that we've already got laws to try and contain morality, because our laws are all really about trying to promote a certain type of morals. You know, to legislate morality, that's what our laws and rules are about.
Yeah.
In my opinion.
Right, yeah. Well, to some degree. I mean, it's an interesting line that people draw, what they're willing to legislate and what they're not, especially in America. I think that's a big deal with, you know, not wanting big government, not wanting to be told what to do. So where you draw the line is interesting, and obviously a matter of some debate between the different sides of opinion in the country. Yeah.
It'd be neat if a banker would call up and take an opinion on that.
Yeah.
I know that there's plenty of local bankers, and I don't know, they're making money off money, so they probably have a little bit of time.
Yeah, that's true. Well, if there are any bankers out there, do call us now on 831-479-1080 and let us know whether you would want to take an oath of integrity. Well, thank you very much for calling in, Jim. I appreciate your thoughts on this topic, and I hope you might call in again.
Will do. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye.
So we're talking about, should integrity be part of conducting business, or is it dog eat dog all the way to the bank? And one of the issues that Jim just brought up is that the culture of the company is really important. And even if you're taking an oath of integrity, or the problem also with regulation would seem to be the fact that if the culture of companies remains the same, then it's going to be hard to achieve much. If the culture remains the same, if the culture is that the ends justify the means as far as making money is concerned, then more regulations, it seems to me, are just going to be seen as a challenge to get around. After such a cataclysmic event as the recession that we just went through, one would think that anything less than a complete culture change would be unacceptable. And yet it seems that quietly business has gone back to usual in the banking world. How do we change things so that a similar crisis doesn't happen again? How do we encourage business to be conducted with integrity? What effect do you think swearing an oath of integrity might have? I wondered whether one effect it might have is in changing the culture of the company. If you are being required to take this oath of integrity and the company is supporting that and everybody is taking it, well, at least it's signaling that the company should be operating from a base of integrity. Whereas I think that in the financial world, especially the markets, it really, the whole atmosphere there is not about that. It's almost more, I don't want to say like a casino, because it's not exactly that, but there's a very high charged kind of sort of atmosphere of just making money, doing the deal, and not really much thought of how those deals get done. So, you know, maybe if the culture changed, that would make a difference. And most companies have integrity as an espoused value. nearly every company says, we combine integrity with excellence. We act with integrity in all we do. We hold honesty and integrity as our guiding principles. But there's one thing talking about that. There's another thing about actually doing it. And although one would think that integrity should be the basic building block for doing business, nobody wants to get involved with a company that lies and cheats its customers, nor do we want to work for a company that's dishonest and disingenuous with employees, as Craig was saying earlier, the way he was treated. So we really need to look at, what we're doing here and how we could possibly change the company's culture. Our company's just cynically saying that they think people, what they think people want to hear. Are they just saying, you know, we've got integrity because that's what they should say? Or are they trying to act with integrity, but it's going wrong somehow? Most people would agree that the banks acted in their own interest in the recent crisis to the point of illegality and acted out of pure greed. However, I'm just wondering also, are we holding the banking world to a different standard than other businesses, large and small? I mean, the reality is we all face integrity-based choices on a regular basis. Do we tell customers about all the warts on our products? Do we reveal everything to a prospective buyer during due diligence? Is it acceptable to hide certain aspects of our background in a resume? What's considered a legitimate expense on a business trip? All these things are things that we all come across every day, and none of them can have clear answers. And no corporate policy is ever going to cover every contingency. So I think, you know, it's something that really needs some deep thought. How can we encourage integrity in business so that we all benefit from it? Because we all would benefit from it if we respect others and they respect us. That's a good place to be. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copland, and we're finishing the first hour with our discussion, our debate this week. And the second hour, just after the news, after three, we're going to be doing our in-depth interview with a guest from the arts. And this week it's with internationally best-selling novelist and screenwriter and Santa Cruz resident Michael Marshall Smith. We'll be talking about his 20-plus year career and latest novel, We're Here. So I hope you can stay with us. I'll see you after the news. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copland on KSCO AM 1080 Santa Cruz.
Again, here's your host, Ruth Copland.
Welcome back. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copland. And this hour, I'm very happy to have in the studio with us New York Times bestselling and British Sunday Times bestselling author Michael Marshall Smith, also writing as Michael Marshall. We're going to be talking about his 20-plus year career and his latest novel, We Are Here, which has been described as chilling, intelligent, and profoundly unsettling. Born in Britain, Michael spent the first 7 years of his childhood in Illinois and Florida, as well as a year in South Africa and another in Australia before returning to the UK. But he's lived in Santa Cruz for the last 3 years with his wife and son. Michael writes dark suspense fiction with a hint of the supernatural. He's the winner of the Philip K. Dick Award, the August Derleth Award for Best Novel, 6 British Fantasy Awards, and the only author ever to win the BFS Award for Best Short Story 4 times. Stephen King referred to his Straw Men trilogy as a masterpiece, brilliantly written. His novel Spares was optioned by Steven Spielberg's DreamWorks, and his supernatural thriller The Intruders is currently being filmed for TV by BBC America. Welcome to the show, Michael.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You've got books published under the names of Michael Marshall Smith and Michael Marshall, and this new book that's come out is under Michael Marshall. I'm just wondering for our listeners, how did that come about?
Well, it's one of those things that it's just sort of endemic to the publishing industry, really. I mean, people's perception. I mean, today I received my first copies, for example, of the UK edition of We Are Here, which looks very, very different to the US edition of We Are Here. And things as small as that can make a difference to, you know, people's perception and whether or not they're likely to buy the book. And The name thing was something like that as well. Basically, I wrote for a long time under the name Michael Marshall Smith, and then I kind of switched genres fairly markedly. And the perception was that people who'd bought my previous books, which had tended to be sort of science fiction-y or, I guess, horror, would be the bracket. I switched to writing the Strawman trilogy, although I didn't know that it was going to be a trilogy at the time, and that was sort of present-day suspense and had none of those other things in it. And the feeling was that people might get, if they weren't expecting one thing and they were given something very different, it might be a problem for them. So it's really just one of those mechanical things of perception.
Right. So if we're looking at Michael Marshall Smith, would that be more horror with those books?
Yeah, I mean, Michael Marshall Smith has a sort of quite an open remit, really, in that he wrote sort of...
You're talking in third person.
Yes.
About
it's
yourself.
It's the royal we. I am legion. tended to be... has more of an open remit. I mean, he's written science fiction novels. He writes horror. He writes pretty much whatever he wants, whereas Michael Marshall has a much tighter brief, or had a much tighter brief. He started off writing... I must stop doing this. It does sound kind of creepy. when writing as Michael Marshall, have tended to write to a slightly tighter brief in terms of suspense novels, although over the last few that has tended to move slightly away from consensual reality, and as you said at the top of the show, a degree of the supernatural, although it depends how you define the supernatural, really.
That's true. How do you define it?
Well, I think there are some things which are very evidently supernatural. If you introduce ghosts or certain types of things, then to most people that steps outside what they believe to be true. But there are an awful lot of people who believe in ghosts. And I think for me it's more a question of not so much defining a book by saying this is not going to be real. It's more a question of saying, okay, how wide are we prepared to believe that reality is? Loads and loads of people believe in ghosts. Loads of people believe in religion. Loads of people have superstitions. Loads of people will believe in the premonitions from dreams or premonitions from their gut. And it's hard to disprove all that stuff. And what's particularly hard, you know, whether or not that's actually true, is it's very, very hard to discount the importance that those things have in people's lives. And so you can have a bunch of scientists say there are no such things as premonitions. But if some people's lives have been shaped by premonitions they felt they've had, or if they tend to organize their life around particular belief systems, then that affects their lives. And whether or not it's true or not is actually sort of irrelevant, really. So I guess I'm interested in the supernatural in the sense of it's the natural but super. It's not some whole different world, some whole different sort of metaphysic. It's more just let's imagine that some of the things that people sincerely believe to be true might actually be true, and let's see what influence that has on a story.
Yeah. And certainly seems to me the more we get into the quantum world, the more likely it seems that some of these things could be true. You know, things like string theory, you know.
It does, and this is what always makes me laugh, because, you know, not all scientists, there are a lot of very open-minded scientists, but a lot of them can be quite damning about certain types of beliefs that people have. And then you hear things exactly like that, or, you know, quantum mechanics, or, you know, recently there was this thing about some scientists who believe they've heard an echo of the Big Bang. Now, as far as I'm concerned, the Big Bang sounds like absolute nonsense. so there was some time and everything was condensed down to a tiny dot and then it all exploded. Where did the dot come from? What happened before that? And yet this is presented as a sort of, this is the cutting edge of science. Believe it. It's like, I've been in churches and heard people say things which sound far more credible than this. So, you know, I'm not going to buy it just because you've got a white coat. And I think why we believe what we believe, so much of what we believe is what we choose to believe anyway, or what's comfortable for us to believe, or what fits in with our presuppositions, or what makes us happy. And to pretend otherwise is, I think, to ignore human nature. And I think, you know, all art, but you know, maybe in particular books, need to be very firmly rooted in what is real human nature.
That's interesting. And you've written science fiction, you've written fantasy, horror. I'm wondering what pulled you in these directions after starting out in comedy at Cambridge University and the BBC.
Yeah, it's funny though. I don't know. I mean, I'd always enjoyed comedy, radio, particularly radio comedy, growing up with the BBC, in which, you know, as you know, has a fantastic tradition of that kind of stuff, and I've just been very drawn to it. I think one of the things that draws some people to comedy, particularly drew me to comedy, is it's all about very precise word use. Mm. If you look at some of the great comic novelists, people like Kingsley Amis, for example, a lot of where he gets his effect is by very, very precise use of language. And so I think that was one of the things that drew me to it. And it was just one of those strange sea changes that happen in your life. I mean, I spent a lot of time doing that. And then by pure chance, an old school friend of mine, in fact, I've completely accidentally been relevant there, and I'll explain why.
Okay.
Because I'd for years been badgering a friend of mine to read Lucky Jim by Kingsley Amis, which is how I'd managed to do this, weirdly. And he said, okay, if you read The Talisman by Stephen King and Peter Straub. And I'd sort of been very dismissive of that kind of literature up till that point. And so we went through the deal. He enjoyed Lucky Jim, and I loved The Talisman. And that was the thing that made me sort of think, because I think I'd had vague desires to write beforehand, because I'd always been an avid reader, but this was the book that made me think, okay, that's the kind of thing, that's the kind of story, that's the kind of, because King at his best, and Straub to a degree, but King at his best has this ability to sort of root things very, very firmly in humanity and human nature, and a realistic view of the world, whilst then precisely opening the doors to very different things. And so I think it was just, and in a way that I always find terrifying about life, these little accidents that push you along one road rather than the other. I mean, you can call it fate, you can call it whatever you want, but it's weird to look back over your life and say, well, if I hadn't done that on that day, I wouldn't be where I am now, you know.
Yeah, that does make you think that, doesn't it? I guess it's where a lot of speculations of beliefs have come from, trying to work out stuff like that.
Mm.
You've said of We Are Here, it's the nearest I've come to marrying the Michael Marshall and Michael Marshall Smith strands of my brain, and therefore the most uncategorizable thing I've ever done, but also, I think, the best.
Do I really say that?
Yeah.
Well, it's probably true then, if I said it.
Apparently, yeah, it's on your website. And you even put, so there, after that. Well, I didn't read that out, but you went, so there. Now, you've written in different genres, but I was wondering, when you come to write, do you think about genre, or are you just, do you just get writing?
I just get writing, really. I mean, it is sometimes I'm aware when I'm writing something that something will fit more easily into a specific genre than others. But in general, writing, most people who write find it reasonably hard.
Mm.
And it's the one of the few things that I've found that makes it a little bit easier for me is to try and place as few restrictions on me as possible. Over the years, that only works so far, because you end up with publishers who, you know, as I said at the beginning, they want a book that they can categorize. They need to know what kind of jacket's going to go on it. They need to know what shelf it's going to go in the bookstore. And so there is often a pressure to make sure that you are going to fit yourself into one sort of niche. What I'm trying to do more and more at the moment is to effectively ignore that and say, this may give me problems down the line, but I will have more fun and I think produce a more authentic and interesting book if I just say, okay, what is the story? What do I want involved in it? And just let my mind be as free as possible.
Hmm. And then do you ever have an editor sort of say, oh, it needs to go a bit more this way or that way to fit, or are they
supportive? No, I mean, they'll sometimes say, can you make it less rubbish? But they won't. They tend not to try and shove you in one particular sort of genre, because I've sort of nailed my colours to the mast on that, really, and they wearily accept that whatever I hand in is not going to fit in one particular sort of box. And I'm very lucky in that my current publishers, I was with one publisher very, very happily for a very long time, but with this book and this is the first book I wrote for my new publishers, and the specific remit there is basically do whatever you want. And so the weird thing is that's actually quite paralyzing in some ways.
Right,
You know, we all know if you've got a deadline, you try to hit it. If someone says, give me this, then you may wail and moan about it, but you will try to give them that. Whereas if someone says, do whatever you want and hand it when you're ready, then it's very, very easy to not really do anything. So I'm having to sort of step up on the self-discipline now.
Yeah. I was wondering about that, because one of your characters in We Are Here reflects on another character. I envied her this level of constant self-determination while knowing that I simply didn't have the energy. And it made me wonder where you lie in this spectrum and how much of an effort is to push yourself forward, or whether you're very driven and organized.
It varies. There are days when I'll get up and I'll sit and I'll type and I'll look up and be astonished that it's 4 o'clock in the afternoon and I've got tons done. And there are other days when it is like pulling teeth. And it's more a question of developing mechanisms for dealing with those days. I mean, the days when it all just flows out, great. You just sit there and do it for as long as you possibly can. The other days, you have to recognize that sometimes it's just not there. I mean, people vary on that. Some people say, okay, I'm going to write 2,000 words a day, and I have to do it. It doesn't matter how rubbish it is. I tend to find that that doesn't work for me, and then what I will do is I'll go back over what I've already written and polish it, and that's okay up to a point, but there comes a point where you've polished it so much that it becomes sort of inviolable and you can't see your way through it. And also something that I've learned is that sometimes those are days when you need to go for a walk, and that might be the day when you get one tiny little inkling which will actually unlock the second half of the book. So, because writing is not just about sitting there and typing, it's also about thinking, it's about making connections, it's about feeling things, experiencing things, and you've got to leave, you know, plenty of room for that in your process too.
Yeah. If you just joined us, you're listening to It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copeland, and my guest today is Michael Marshall Smith. We're going to go to a commercial break now, but do keep it here, and we'll see you after the break. You're listening to KSCO AM 1080. Welcome back to It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copeland. My guest of this hour is the best-selling author and screenwriter Michael Marshall Smith, also writing as Michael Marshall. And we just started to talk a bit about his new novel that's just come out in Britain and America called We Are Here. And this book is about, I was going to read you a little synopsis. It should have been the greatest day of David's life. A trip to New York, wife by his side to visit his new publisher. Finally, after years of lonely struggle, it looks as though the gods of fate are on his side. But on the way back to Penn Station, a chance encounter changes all of that. David bumps into a man who covertly follows him, and just before he boards the train, passes by him close enough to whisper, "Remember me." When the stranger turns up in his hometown, David begins to understand that this man wants something from him, something very personal that he may have no choice but to surrender. Meanwhile, back in New York, ex-lawyer John Henderson does his girlfriend Christina a favor and agrees to talk to Catherine Warren, an acquaintance of hers who believes she's being stalked by an ex-lover. But soon John realizes that Catherine's problem is far more complex and terrifying than he could ever have imagined. There are people out there in the shadows, watching, waiting. They are the forgotten, and they're about to turn. And the Daily Mail in Britain has said, on one hand, this is an absorbing thriller. On the other, it provokes us to mistrust our perceptions of reality, to doubt the facts of our familiar surroundings. Engrossing and uncanny. And I am currently reading it. I was reading it on the plane home from Britain. I'm halfway through, just about, and I can vouch for it, and at the risk of sounding sycophantic, I can say it is really, really good. It's very good, Michael. It's
I'm enjoying it.
Brilliantly written, very well written, and I'm really enjoying that, but also just the plot and narrative, everything. It's very good. So.
Yeah, thank you. Well, it was actually the first, it was written in Santa Cruz, so that's the first book that I actually wrote in Santa Cruz.
Oh, really? So,
yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
That's interesting. So, out of We're Here, a wife comments to her writer husband, "You wrote it, and it's great, and it's going to be published. Everything else is out of your hands. I'm proud of what you do, not for what fate throws your way." And this seems a very sensible and philosophical way to look at literary success. I'm wondering how much your own perspective is similar to this, and also whether how a book is received changes your own view of it.
Ooh, it's an interesting one. I mean, there is a degree to which once you've written it, you do hand it over. And that's something that you've got to do, because there are people out there who do the marketing, the publicity and sales. And, you know, these are real jobs that, that people do and are much better at than you ever will be. So to a degree, you do need to hand over control to people to do those things. It's very frustrating sometimes, because you've spent a year and a half of your life doing something and you then hand it over to people.
Right.
But I know that they'd be doing a far better job of it than I would. And in a way, that's slightly coming back now with things like the growth of social media and so on. To a degree, it's being handed back to the author to do a certain amount of that promotion themselves and to project a certain persona on the web, which is something that I personally am not very fond of doing and I'm not very good at doing. Some people are extremely good at doing it. Some people regard it as a bit of a chore. I personally am in the latter camp.
Right.
But it's, I mean, you know, that's all you can do, really. You have to hand it out there. And so much of it is in the hand of fate. It's very difficult to predict what hit a particular zeitgeist at any particular time. And you people's perception of it, if people say a book is rubbish, then if you respect that person's opinion and if they have a track record for useful and insightful criticism and commentary, then of course you need to take it on board because that would be foolish otherwise. But, you know, the web is dominated now by places where you can assign however many stars you want. And, you know, you've also got to think, okay, well, Deirdre, whoever you are from Arkansas, I have no reason to particularly, you know, admire or respect your literary acumen. So if you think it sucks, you know, sorry you spent the $5.99, but, you know, them's the breaks. So you have to develop quite a thick skin on this because you know, I always say, you know, it sounds a bit too much, but to a degree, books are like, you know, children in effect. You've brought them up, you've helped create them, but then they go on and have a totally independent life, which you have no control over, and you have to say, well, you did the best that you can, and now they go off and have a life all of their own, and there's a limit to what you can do to influence that in some ways.
Yeah, that must be hard. Well, like, it's hard letting go of your children, isn't it, too? So in We Are Here, you quote Gerard de Nerval saying, "I believe that the human imagination never invented anything that was not true in this world or any other." Based on your writing, that would mean there's some pretty crazy dark stuff going on out there. What are your thoughts on
that? I suspect what he meant by that, and this sort of ties in slightly to the André Gide quote at the beginning as well, which is something along the lines of, you know, in the realm of the emotions, the real is no different to the imaginary. And I don't think that just because people have invented things in books, it necessarily means that there are vampires. But I think what that means is that what vampires mean to us reflects something that we believe or suspicions or fears or concerns that we have. And so I think very often the specific events or monsters in a broader sense that are in books reflect something about human nature. I don't think that necessarily means that, you know, everything we've invented is true. I hope not, anyway.
No. That's what I was thinking.
In every work of art, particularly books, is a reflection of something that we either believe or fear. Or a particular type of emotion. And a lot of these things are basically metaphors for certain types of things that we feel or certain types of psychological processes. So I think, yes, all of these things do reflect a reality about the kind of thing that we think. It doesn't mean they necessarily exist.
No. And I think from my perspective, a lot of it also represents internal archetypes, you know, so something like a vampire or something, you know, can reflect something in the unconscious within us, also, which I think is an interesting thing looking at in books.
Well, particularly in the horror genre, because you can very easily trace things like, you know, Frankenstein was basically about the nascence of science as a driving force in society, people's fears about that. Alien Invasion in the 50s was all about the Cold War. Serial killers in the 70s and 80s was a realization that actually we didn't need to be worried about people outside our borders, but that there were fractures and schisms within our own societies, and that the enemy might well be within. So very often these sort of tropes of genre fiction, particularly horror, which is one of the reasons why it's actually quite an interesting genre despite how much it's looked down upon, actually reflect very real cultural change, and often do it very, very quickly in a way that literature, so-called literature, sometimes takes quite a long time to catch up on.
Yeah. Just picking up on what you said about people looking down on horror, I know I interviewed Tad Williams and we spoke a little bit about, you know, genre fiction in general being looked down on. I guess there's some hierarchy within genre fiction that some are worse than others.
Right at the bottom, trust me.
Well, what do you think that is about?
I think it's because, I mean, you know, Tad's a great example because Tad is a great writer. You're a very subtle writer, great user of prose with massive, incredibly complicated stories and very sophisticated, subtle understanding of society and so on. I really don't know. I mean, because very, you know, I tend to think, you know, think back 20, 30,000 years, and there's people sitting around a campfire. Are they telling stories about the nanny? Are they telling stories about, you know, concerns about house prices? No, they're not. They're telling stories about what is that noise that we hear in the forest? Is something going to come and get us?
Yeah.
You know, do we have enough food? They're about visceral things to do with real life. They're to do with real fears and real concerns and the things that really make us happy. And I think, I don't know, it's almost like, the genres that tend to reflect that most accurately tend to be looked down upon, whereas the stuff that's a bit fluffier or more abstruse gets more respect. And I don't know what that is. Maybe it's a sort of almost a sort of distrust of some of these emotions. They're seen as sort of dirty thrills because they appeal so viscerally to what we actually feel and believe. I don't know. It's a difficult, tricky one.
Is there some truth in the perception that maybe some of the writers in those genres are sort of just churning stuff out more than being good writers?
Well, without question. I mean, you know, just, I mean, I don't particularly, you know, associate myself with the horror genre. But, there's an awful lot of rubbish written. And, you know, there are some very interesting, very eerie and uncanny horror movies made. And there are some appalling slices of torture porn, which, you know, one would wish had never been made. But the same is true of a lot of any genre, really. There's some interesting romantic fiction. There's some terrible schlock. There's some very interesting and subtle literature written. There's also some very boring stuff as well. So, you know, yes, of course, there's great variation within the quality in any particular genre, but there isn't in any genre, really. And, you know, I have a problem with the genre boundaries because I think they're so arbitrary and they're so time-specific as well. I mean, if you take a writer like D.H. Lawrence, who wrote a story called The Rocking Horse Winner about a boy who gets on a rocking horse, and the faster he rocks, he starts to be able to predict the winners of horse races. Now, if I were to write that, they'd go, yeah, great, it's another horror story. Or it's weird, it's supernatural, but this is D.H. Lawrence. You know, these distinctions have become much more rigid, partly because of marketing, partly because of the internet, partly because of publishing and things like that. Really, there's only two genres, I think, which are fiction and nonfiction, and even those boundaries can get very, you know, in cold blood. Yeah, a lot of, you know, they're just not important, which is why it's something that I tend not to sort of focus too much on.
And you've managed very well to straddle these different genres and not be pigeonholed.
Well, whether that's good, very well, I've managed very well to avoid any sort of commercially successful pigeonhole. Yes, I've done awesome at that.
Well done.
Yeah.
I think you're being a bit modest there, but anyway. In We Are Here, there's a character who's a writer, and speaking about his writing process, you say he had no idea of what happens next, and he was okay with that. Plot lines he knew all too well could be jettisoned. You could decide they led nowhere good and elect to strike them from the story. So I was wondering, when you have an idea for a novel, how does it grow? What's your process? And do you kind of go off on something and then cut it out completely? Is that something you would ever do?
It's cutting something out completely is very hard, particularly if you've slaved away over it. I mean, my process is chaotic and not to be emulated.
Stop listening now.
Do something else for 10 minutes because you really don't want to do this. There tends to be one central core idea, which often may end up being buried very deep in the final thing, but that's the thing that starts me thinking. And there will be a couple of incidents, there will be some characters, and I'll have a sort of start, and then I'll probably have a couple of almost like hillside bonfires along the way that I think, okay, well, at some point I'm going to get over to that mountain over there, and then when I get there, there'll be another one on the fire. It tends to be quite chaotic. I try to plan, but it's the bit that I find least interesting, to be honest. It's more the experience of getting there that tends to be richer for me. And I think sometimes that gives quite interesting results. I mean, I read an interesting book about the Coen brothers a while back, where basically they admitted that when they write screenplays, they basically start, and they have an idea of where they're going, and it's not dissimilar in some ways, but they're not allowed to go back and change things. If they find that they've backed themselves into a corner, they then have to write themselves out of that corner, whatever that takes. And I think that's one of the reasons why, at their best, their movies have that slightly odd dreamlike quality, because they have gone down one road and they've got to find some way back out of it again. And that can provide some very interesting challenges sometimes. I mean, it can also mean that you spend 2 weeks staring at the computer, hating it, hating the job, wanting to do something else. But quite apart from anything else, this is what I do. This is my life, and I want it to be something that I get something out of rather than just sit and do by rote. And that process of saying, okay, well, I'm gonna take a week to plan this, and then I'll take however many weeks to bash it out, and then I'll edit it, and then I'll go on to the next one. That doesn't feel very fulfilling or interesting to me. The journey, the process, the finding out what happens along the way and reacting to that is what I enjoy about it. So don't do that. That's my advice.
Works for you, though.
Sometimes.
So with a book like We're Here, I'm halfway through. It's really interesting. It involves things that are very different. Obviously, I'm not giving anything away about it. I don't know how it's going to end. I mean, halfway through, would you have known how it was going to end? Do you work like that, or is it really very open?
It depends what you mean by know how it's going to end. I knew how it was going
to
end.
Sort of conceptually, I suppose.
Conceptually, absolutely.
Yes, knew
how
okay.
It was going to end. Yeah. I mean, when I start a book knowing how the ideas
come together
and what they mean. How that may be manifest in terms of specific events on the page, that tends to be something that gets thrashed out along the way.
And do you ever write ahead? Do you ever sort of like, find, oh, I don't want to write this section, but I know what happens here, so I'm going to write that, or do you just keep going all the way through?
It varies, and that's something that's depended very much book by book. There have been books that I've written where I've thought, okay, this incident's going to happen at some stage, I'll write it down now, and then, you know, possibly months later, I thought, okay, now's the time to do that. And there are other books that I've written in a far more linear fashion. It tends to vary.
Yeah. You've got a great turn of phrase, as well as delivering amazing plots and concepts. Beautiful narrative and also a lot of human insights, and I just wanted to pick one out that stood out for me, that what I've read so far. Cars and trucks stood at discrete distances from one another, like people awaiting the results of blood tests that would not reflect well on their lifestyles. I just thought that was just such an interesting like way of describing traffic. I mean, you know, it was funny and just different. And
yeah, well, it's that's part of the pleasure actually coming up with those sort of things. But the truth of it is, to a degree, I find that that kind of thing tends to just come out of the fingers without thinking about it too hard.
And yeah, absolutely.
Stuff that I struggle with that requires discipline is the actually thinking, okay, what happens next? You know, that's the bit that tends to require more mental effort for me.
Yes, yeah. And you're sort of mixing together elements of humor, observation, love, horror, suffering all together. I guess that just comes naturally to you as part of the experience of life.
Well, it does. And I think for a book to be a valuable way of spending time, it needs to reflect human experience in general. And that's the kind of people we're like. You'll go to a funeral and someone will make a joke because that's how we experience life, and that's how we deal with life. And I think a book should reflect that. A book with absolutely no humor in it would be a very dull experience, and also I think just inhuman in some fundamental way. So,
and yet there are so many without any. But Michael Marshall Smith's books are not in that category, you'll be glad to know. So we've been talking about his book, We Are Here, which has just come out in America. I would recommend that you go out and buy it. You can get it at all good bookshops. If you want to learn more about Michael Marshall Smith, you can also go to his website, Michael Marshall with two L's, smith.com. You can find out a lot of stuff there. He has a great blog, and he's written a lot of stuff. So you can check out there his previous work as well. But the new novel is We Are Here. We're going to go to a commercial break now. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copland and my guest of this hour, Michael Marshall Smith, on KSCO AM 1080 Santa Cruz. Welcome back. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copland, and my guest from the arts this hour is Michael Marshall Smith, internationally best-selling author and screenwriter, also writing as Michael Marshall, which is what his new book, We Are Here, is penned under, supernatural thriller. And we were talking about it earlier. I quoted, though, you'd forgotten that you said it's the best thing you've done. I was wondering what your criteria are for making that judgment, should you still agree with it.
That's generally the most recent thing I've done to me. I think, you referred to earlier about You know, because I've had this weird schism between the two, the Michael Marshall Smith and the Michael Marshall, and for quite a while they were quite far apart. And because I never really chose to do that, I didn't do what someone like Ian Banks did, which was have Ian Banks and Ian M. Banks as a specific decision to have two very different strands of literature.
Yeah.
It just kind of happened. And I found it a bit of a pain in some ways. And so I think to try and sort of join those two things back again. And also, We Are Here has quite a big cast of characters. It's about, it has themes like friendship and how we navigate our way through our lives with and without friends and the pain of being forgotten, that kind of stuff, which I think are quite important things to do with life. I do think it's the best thing that I've done, but I mean, I hope I will always think that the most recent thing I've done is the best thing that I've done. You know, you never want to get to the end of a book thinking, well, it's kind of B-list, you want it to be good.
That's true. Yeah, that makes sense. As I said, I'm only halfway through, but reading it, I could really
see
it.
Second half, brilliant.
Is it?
Oh, God. So much.
I thought you were going to say it was crap for a bit.
Yeah, don't read the second half. No.
Good. Well, it's only going to get better, which means it must be really, really good, because the first half is very good. But I could really envisage it as a film. And I wanted to ask you, obviously, your book, The Intruders, is currently being filmed by BBC America, starring John Sim, who I love. For people who might not be familiar with the name, he was in Life on Mars and he played the Master in Doctor Who. He's a great actor. And also Mira Sorvino. I said that the first time, then I was like, is that right? So how does that feel for that to get made? Because I think they optioned it a while ago, did they? Or
I mean, the whole thing has been a very odd but characteristic sort of film and TV experience, really. I mean, it was, The Intruders was optioned by the BBC in London pretty soon after it came out, and they then doggedly and with a great deal of sort of enthusiasm and commitment developed it for a number of years. A great producer there called Jess Pope, who really gave it her all. And it just didn't happen. I mean, they went through three different sets of screenwriters. I was involved in it for a bit, and they just could not quite get it to land. Part of the problem being The Intruders is set in America, and they were very keen at that stage to reset it in the UK, and they're just, I always firmly believe that the locale of a book should be a character and should very firmly underwrite what's happening. And transferring it to the UK just didn't work. And so I think that was fundamentally a slightly flawed endeavor. But then, and to be honest, I'd sort of given up on it. And then I heard that Jane Tranter, who previously worked there and was now heading up BBC Worldwide in LA, had taken it on. Which I was very enthusiastic about because, you know, she's excellent and has done some very good stuff. But again, I didn't hear anything about it for a year, and I sort of assumed it was, you know, I'd had a couple of brief conversations with them and then sort of assumed it was rolling off into the weeds. And then literally got an email one night saying, this is going to be greenlit tomorrow.
Wow. Gosh.
And so from that period on, I assumed that it was an admirable but very sort of complicated practical joke on the basis of some old school friend or somebody who particularly hated me. And each piece of evidence that came up, I mean, you know, when John Sim was cast, I thought, yeah, you've gone a bit far there. Obviously, it won't have John Sim in it. And Glenn Morgan is the showrunner and an exec and lead writer on it. And, you know, Glenn was very involved in The X-Files and a fantastic TV writer. And so you've got that. And then you've got Mira Sorvino and James Frayne. And you've got Jane Tranter and Judy Gardner. And, you know, just all of these. It just,
great people.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great, great, great team. But I can't remember what it was about. Probably about a month ago, I went up to Vancouver, which is where it's being shot, for the table read, where the actors first sit down and read through the scripts.
Oh, yeah.
Got an idea of, you know, how lines fit in their mouths and so on.
Yeah.
And it was only on that trip, watching that and being shown around the studio and seeing all the production stuff and so on, that I actually finally sort of thought, okay, this really is probably going to happen. So
probably because the budget for a joke at that point was a bit high.
Even my friends who hate me the most wouldn't have spent that much money to do that. So it does seem like it's going to happen. And, you know, I've seen a couple of updates on it. I've read the first four scripts. I haven't seen the second four. Signs are very good.
Now, you've done a lot of screenplay adaptations and screenwriting, but you're not doing that for this. Is there a particular reason for that? Or?
They wanted someone who could do it well, I think was the, no, seriously. I mean, you know, false modesty aside, I'm a prose writer. I, like a lot of prose writers, have dabbled in screenwriting with spectacular lack of success. Mm. And to be honest, I think a lot of writers think, wouldn't it be great if somebody options my novel, they'll pay me to write the screenplay. And to be, you don't want them to pay you to write the screenplay. You want them to
hire the best
screenwriter they've got. because the more money they spend on the screenwriter, the more likely it's going to go forward. And you want a really good script. You want the names attached to it to be good. And just having that sort of vanity thing of you having a crack at it, unless you're an excellent screenwriter, it's the absolute last thing you want. You want somebody good on it fast. And someone like Glenn Morgan is exactly what you want. An incredibly good and experienced TV screenwriter. That's exactly what you want on it. And added to which, and I, because I was involved with The Intruders way back with the BBC in London, and it was the first time I tried to adapt something of mine. And if you've just spent a year putting a bunch of stuff in, to then spend a year taking a lot of it out and reconfiguring it and try to rethink it, it's, I think it's far better to say, okay, hand this to people, hand this, it's like the publishing thing, the marketing, hand it to others whose job it is.
Yeah.
Trust them to do a good job because there's always another book you should be writing.
Yeah, that makes sense. And it's going to be a different animal, isn't it? I mean, every film you go to see, if you've read the book, it's not like the book. I mean, it's a different art form, isn't it?
They're actually doing a pretty faithful adaptation of this, which is good.
Yeah.
Because I have done a certain amount of screenwriting over the years, I don't deliberately, but I'm somewhat conscious of certain ways of telling stories, and you know, the suspense model tends to be closer to the film model in terms of information delivery than a lot of other genres, and so it probably falls naturally that way.
Mm.
But yeah, I mean, you've got to. I expected and was reconciled to them ripping far more stuff out than they have, or changing a lot more stuff around. But I think, you know, everything that I've seen so far, I've thought, yeah, that makes sense. Of course, you're going to have to do that. Because it's very different. You hope that you have a contract with a prose novel that people will sit down, and once they trust you, they'll think, okay, well, I'll wait this out. I'll see how this is all going to tie together. But if you then take that story and divide it into 8 1-hour chunks, people expect different things. There's an episode structure. People want certain things within one episode. Otherwise, it's an unsatisfying set. It's a very different discipline, really. So that's, again, why I'm happy to hand it over to people with experience.
Right. And do we know when it's going to come out, possibly?
I don't think we are 100% sure. I've heard the fall, something like August, September on BBC America here. I understand that it's also due to be going out on BBC Two in England, but that, again, is not set in terms of date yet.
Well, that's soon, though, isn't it? That's exciting.
It is. Yeah? It's very exciting, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Now, you've also written a lot of short stories, and Neil Gaiman has said of your short stories, it's not the craft and skill that Michael Marshall Smith displays in his short stories that I object to. It's not the easy wit or the comfortable way he deploys language as a weapon. It's not even that way that he can conjure people so real in so few words. It's that when a Mike Smith short story is over, it's pretty much guaranteed that there will be some moment, scene or revelation frozen in the back of my mind that I'll never be able to get out of my head, not even if I scrub it with wire wool so it bleeds. So it's kind of, there's an element of backhanded complimenting going on there, but obviously maybe that's a good thing for him, and for people who want to have a very dramatic story, that's obviously you're delivering that in your short stories.
I don't know if this is a dramatic story, but I think, you know, and I think what I've found is that different types of ideas and different things you might want to say, different media suit them better.
Mm.
And I think the thing that a short story can do is it can give you, it tends to be quick in and out.
Yeah.
You can just focus on something in particular. You don't have to develop a huge amount of breadth. You can focus on emotion and presentation and atmosphere. And that's often the best way of taking one particular idea, be it a nice one or a very uncomfortable one, and just trying to inject it very firmly into people's heads. Whereas novels are about something much bigger and different.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good way of looking at it. And MMS Press, which is EMEMESS.com, that publishes, I think it's 27 of your short stories.
Yeah, I mean, that was actually a project I started myself, because it's one of the short stories, I think, in some genres are absolutely the best story delivery mechanism there are.
Mm.
But the problem is that they tend not to have much life after they've initially been published. Selling collections, short story collections tend to be very unpopular, because I think a lot of people don't realize just how good short stories can be. And it was more a question of me saying, you know, I've written nearly 100 short stories over the year.
Wow, gosh.
They're just sort of sitting on, they've been published, pretty much all of them, but then now they're just sitting on my hard disk. What's a way of giving them a little bit of extra life? And so that's what I'm doing.
So people can get them from MMS.com?
Yeah, if you go to MMS.com, then you can buy Kindle downloadable versions, basically.
Right, and there's a whole variety. I mean, that quote I read implies that they're on the darker fiction side, but I think there are also there's a variety.
There are a few stories that you would necessarily want to be the last thing you'd read before going to sleep.
There are a few, did you say?
Very few, yes.
Not bedtime stories, then.
Well, it depends. It depends what you're doing in your bedtime, I suppose, really. But I do tend towards somewhat the darker or sometimes more melancholy or spookier end of stuff. You're not going to find romantic fiction or recipes amongst them. They do tend to be somewhat of that type.
Right. If you just joined us, I'm talking to Michael Marshall Smith about his work and also his latest novel, We Are Here, which has just come out in Britain and America, and which I can highly recommend based on reading half of it. And apparently the second half is superb. So it can only get better from here on. We're coming towards the end of the show. I was wanting to ask you, you've touched on it in several answers, but, you know, art is about communication. Do you feel you're trying to communicate something specific through your work, or is it different for every book?
I think it's different for every book. I mean, I think there have been some things which have come up time and time again, which is the degree to which we generally, all of us, operating in more than one reality at a time.
Right.
Either the idea of there being something behind a Gnostic veil, or the fact that we do one thing while we're thinking another, or that we're actually one way and we present another. That sort of dualism is certainly inherent in The Intruders and in a lot of stuff that I do. But also I think my fundamental interest is always in human nature and why we do what we do, and how that impacts on other people, and the sort of complex net of relationships that come on the basis of the people we interact with now, what's happened in our past. I mean, it's obvious stuff. This is what books are about. But I mean, there's just so much of it. There's so much stuff to look at. And of course, one's understanding of oneself and of other people changes so much over time as you meet new people, as you have new experiences, as you get older.
Yeah. No, that's very, very true. And we have only got a minute and a half left, 2 minutes left. But I really did want to ask you this, and you might not be able to answer it in 60 seconds, but it's very interesting how you have the different perspectives in the novels that I've read of yours. You know, you have different first person, third person, different tenses. Why do you do that? What does that give you?
Again, it's just this sort of slight greed thing that I have, really, and that there's something about the first person voice which is extremely direct. It's someone sitting in a pub and telling you a story, and there's something very engaging about that. On the other hand, it's quite limiting. Third person voice is great because you can spread over a wide variety of things and move around through time and space in a very flexible way, but you don't have that immediacy you do with the first person voice. So in the same way that I thought, well, why do I have to stick with one particular genre? I thought, well, why do I have to stick to one particular voice?
Yeah, that makes complete sense. Mm. So if you want to find out more about Michael Marshall Smith, you can go to michaelmarshallsmith.com. That's Marshall with two L's. You can get his books, of which there are very many. How many are there? A lot.
About 12 novels, I think.
Yeah. Any good bookstore, local bookstore, Bookshop Santa Cruz?
I should know that, really, but I think
yeah. Makes me feel better that I don't know, that you don't know either. You can also get his short stories at MMS.com. Thank you so much for coming in, Michael. It was great to have you in the studio. His new book, We Are Here, go out and buy it. You've been listening to It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copland on KSCO AM 1080 Santa Cruz.